There is a romantic idea about creative inspiration, that it arrives like a gift or a visitation, that it descends from above, that if you're lucky or talented enough or chosen, the ideas will simply come to you. And when you're young, it can feel like that. Youth, it is said, is wasted on the young. But one thing the young are rarely short on is ideas. When you're starting out, inspiration seems endless. The well gives water, the wind keeps blowing, the fire keeps burning, the butter keeps churning. When we're young, what we lack in experience or rewards, we make up for in hunger. And the hunger itself seems to summon the work. But there comes that moment, probably for everyone, when the well begins to run dry, when the wind dies down, when the fire is reduced to embers, and when suddenly you cannot find a stick of butter to save your life. That is the moment when the artist is tested, when the romantic ideas stop working and inspiration, as a strategy, fails. My friend, the late writer Peter Straub, once told me on this podcast something that I've carried with me ever since. Inspiration is real, but it's earned. You don't wait for it. You work for it. You show up so that it knows where to find you. When motivation wanes, discipline takes its place. Magic is fleeting. Labor is endless potential. Even the most naturally gifted artists, the one who seemed to have unlimited access to the muse in their early years, will tell you the same thing. Eventually, it comes down to showing up. You look the work straight in the eyes and you say, I'm not going anywhere. But don't take my word for it. Ask Karen Ann. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Karen Ann Zadel, known simply as Karen Ann, was born in Israel. She spent her early years in the Netherlands and then later moved to France. Her father was a Russian Jew, her mother Dutch Javanese. From an early age, she had a sense of belonging to many worlds and of not fully belonging to any single one. So she grew up intensely aware that everything was changeable, from her location to her language. The flexibility that comes from growing up multilingual and multicultural served her work later on. Even before she picked up a guitar, it seemed clear, at least to her, that music would be a part of her story. She began writing songs as a young teenager, and by her mid-20s, she was making her living as a professional songwriter, thanks in large part to an unexpected collaboration with the legendary singer Henri Salvador, who was in his 80s at the time. Karen Ann co-wrote many of Salvador's late-in-life songs, like the hit Jardin d'Hiver, and helped to revive his career in its final chapter.
Je voudrais du soleil vert, des dentelles et des théières, des photos de bord de mer, dans mon jardin d'hiver. Je voudrais de la lumière, comme en Nouvelle-Angleterre. Je veux changer d'atmosphère. Dans mon jardin d'hiver.
It was around that same time that she began releasing albums of her own. From her debut, La Biographie de Luca Philipsen, she showed a strong sense of herself as a writer, a singer, and a producer. The album was written entirely in French, but it nodded to the breadth of her influences, even in its title, which borrows from Suzanne Vega's song Luca and from her maternal grandmother's maiden name, Philipsen. The sound of the album was elegant, and it felt vaguely European, but modern and raw in its own way, and it signaled an openness and a curiosity in Karen Ann.
Rien d'autre qu'un arbre, une pomme et un peu de sable.
By her second album, La Disparation, she was settling into a career in French, taking her place in the lineage of French pop and chanson singers like Françoise Hardy.
Tombe les nuits.
And then with her third album, Not Going Anywhere, Karen Ann pivoted into a stretch of nearly 15 years of making records entirely in English, with the occasional French song woven in.
People come and go and walk away, but I am not going anywhere. I am not going.
The one exception to her commitment to making music in English during that time was the album Nolita. It was a bilingual album recorded largely in New York, but shaped as much by solitude as it was by any one place. Nolita was an album that drank from the Manhattan tap, but spoke with what she calls the dust of an accent.
Je pourrais bien brûler les preuves, trier les pages de mon passé, prendre un bassin ou même un fleuve pour abonder le peu que j'ai.
Alongside her solo career, Karen Ann's reputation as a collaborator grew. Her songs have been performed by the likes of Iggy Pop and Jane Birkin, and she's worked with collaborators ranging from David Byrne and Questlove to the Icelandic musician Barthi Johansson, who she formed a duo with called Lady and Bird. Late last year, 25 years after her first album, she released Paris Amour, a record that was written from her apartment in Montmartre, overlooking the city of Paris. Much in the way that she did with Nolita years before, she made Paris Amour from the vantage point of a city, but not necessarily about that city. Because while she acknowledges the importance of place in her writing, her process leans towards solitude. Appropriately, then, the album opens with a song called Sublime Solitude.
Je sais que mes yeux ne cachent plus la blessure des longtemps enterrés au fond de mes bagages, et que sur le terrain nul ne paraît très sûr, ni la vue imprenable, ni le parfum sauvage de la haute altitude, et son allié absurde, la sublime solitude.
Even in her self-imposed quiet, she's rarely alone. Literature, memory, and her own inner monologue keep her company. The best teachers, she says, are the ones that she finds in books, and the best way to understand the present is often to read the past. So we met on a rainy November morning in a hotel lobby in Châtelet to talk about her past and her present. For Karen Ann, creativity has become less about inspiration and more about showing up, about labor, and responsibility. And that focus on the process rather than the outcome led to one of the central revelations of our conversation. Art, she believes, is defined by process. AI, on the other hand, is defined by results. We are not artists because of results, she tells me. We are artists because of the process. What emerges here is a portrait of an artist engaged with her process, still listening, still committed to the work, and as ever, not going anywhere. Karen Ann's musical journey began in earnest when she got her first guitar at the age of 9. She was lucky to have the encouragement of her family who recognized her interest in music and her desire to know more. If you have a young budding musician in your life, Musication is a wonderful resource to help you find the right teacher. Musication offers in-home music lessons in Brooklyn and Manhattan for kids ages 3 and up. Their teachers are highly experienced professional musicians, and every lesson is tailored to each child's interests and needs with flexible scheduling that fits into real life. Life is busy, your kids are busy, Musication teachers come to you. As a special offer for Third Story listeners, visit musication.nyc, mention the podcast, The Third Story, and you'll receive 2 free trial lessons. Visit third-story.com for the full archive. It's hundreds of deep diving conversations like this one, including previous episodes recorded in various cafes, hotel rooms, and apartments in Paris, like the ones with singers Madeline Peyrou and Alani, writers Howard Becker and Jake Lamar, saxophone player Rick Margitza, and filmmaker Mary Sweeney. Check out my Substack for the latest writings and musings. Join the mailing list there as well to get all the updates and support the project if you can. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember, we're made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning content. Here's me and Karen Ann talking it down. You know what? This is a great place to start, Karen Ann. As we make coffee and water in this divey hotel lobby in Châtelet, I need to share with you something that as I was looking through my email yesterday for confirmation of what time we were meeting, whatever, I found an email that I sent through your website in 2014 when I started this podcast.
Oh, wow.
And I had a short list of people that I hoped that I would get to talk to for this project.
But only to say that I found buried deep in my emails from over a decade ago. So you were born in Israel, you're also sort of Dutch. You could claim a lot of identities if you wanted to.
Yes, I do. I feel a belonging to many places.
Yeah.
I feel, I haven't lived enough in Israel. I was very little to claim fully being, you know, having, how do you say, any power of thought of what should be done or anything, but I mean...
You mean politically?
Even socially or culturally, I love going there, I love playing there, I love... But I'm just saying I have lived enough there to feel a belonging, to feel that I...
You spent your first 6 years there, 7 years?
Yeah, 6 years.
Yeah.
And seven if we count, because we did back and forth for a while. I did live there enough to understand how much this place has to give and everything in terms of the history, the land, the place in the Middle East, and what the Middle East could look like. It attached me to a territory, the whole Middle East, everything, because it comes with so much culture, whether it's Lebanese or Syrian or Jordanian or Iranian, or right, that like Israel is full of that from all the people who came from different countries from the Middle East and from Eastern Europe and gathered. So it gave me a belonging, a sense of belonging. I haven't lived a lot in Holland, but I've lived enough to know that I do not have this belonging.
Mm.
So I do have, there is something very, I feel very strongly about the flatness, the nature.
Of Holland.
Of Holland. There's something very intriguing. It is very flat.
Yeah.
But I also feel very disturbed by the fact that there is no valley or mountain. And there are no forests, which is exactly why in the Second World War, so many Jews were...
Nowhere to hide.
Yeah, nowhere to hide. You know, it's one of the reasons. Yeah. There are a lot of other reasons. Yeah. It's also because they kept track of ethnicities, which other countries didn't do in Europe. It was allowed there. So it was just enough for me to understand that my belonging to Holland, the family that went through war in Holland, in my case, with my mom, certainly they were not Jewish.
Yeah.
Her mom came from Java in Indonesia.
Really?
So, and the family was very colorful. Like, my mom had all older brothers and younger brothers, and they all married from different parts of the globe. And there were a lot of skin colors in the family. So the family grew up with a lot of discomfort in the village they were in, enough to feel a sense of compassion for Holland, enough to... say that I love the street food and there is fun to it, and enough to feel a belonging to the artistry and the history of art, because Rembrandt, Van Gogh, Vermeer, you know, there's, and also like all the Harlem, and there are certain towns that are related to a certain form of art that has influenced me a lot, but enough to feel that I do not belong in terms of I can live without going there.
Did you speak Dutch at all with your mother?
You mean the it's more of a throat disease? Yeah. Yeah, I did.
You know, it's funny, it's a throat disease maybe, but I think it gives you great preparation for picking up other languages. The Dutch seem to be, and generally, I think Northern Europeans, because of maybe the throat disease that they're faced with.
Probably, because their language is so ugly that they have to speak other languages, yeah.
I mean, between Hebrew and Dutch, probably prepares you to pick up a lot of other languages.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that the last of the four for me was French.
Yeah.
And it has been ever since, because I have, the relation to the French language for me is endless. It's like, if you choose a husband or a wife that you're going to discover for the rest of your life, and you think you never know, no matter how much, that's the relationship I have to the French language. That's my
constantly that's my discovering.
Constantly discovering, constantly realizing that I got it all wrong, constantly realizing that I know it so well, and then, you know, going back and forth. I know it well, I don't know it well.
Yeah.
And it's changing and it's evolving, and I love working with it. And when I started writing in French, I worked a lot with dictionaries, you know, like English, French, French, English, or I guess this also helped create a certain sound identity in my writing that seemed sexy at the time, because if I look at my first records more than 25 years ago and or songs that I wrote for other people, there was something about it that probably brought, rather than an accent, but some dust of an accent or some dust of... exiles.
Yes.
I was very fond of writers who wrote in French that weren't French to begin with, because I thought,
and you related.
They can do it, and they're daring. I loved the Eastern European poets who came to France and dared to write in French. They helped me a lot to break the fear and to just to remain humble and say, okay, I'm not trying to level up with great poets that I'm reading, but I am trying to find my own sound.
Was your father not French? He's Israeli?
Israeli. His parents, he had Ukraine and then Polish and Russian and Hebrew, and my mom had Indonesian and French through her dad. So my mom was a Francophile completely, and they met in Paris.
So what was the language at home?
It was sort of a broken English between them, between a lot of us, and then my dad would really want us to keep the Hebrew, so he'll always speak in Hebrew even if we replied in other languages. Yeah. And then my mom tried out the Dutch, but it didn't work out. And then she realized that since we were going to be living in France anyway, might as well just speak French to us. And
is that strange to have had the language of the house change? Like,
yes.
I would think that would be the one thing that for most families that move through the world would be the sort of the common thread that runs through it. If we're in Israel or if we're in Holland or if we're in France, my mother speaks to me in the same language. But in your case, she changed languages.
Yes, both changed, my dad and my mom. Mostly my mom, and I think it's something that I've been researching a lot in terms of language and hereditary memory when it comes to psychoanalysis. I try to speak one language at home with my daughter, even though she goes to school in French, we speak English, so she has both. We do sometimes switch to French when she has friends over or I have friends over, but I do try because there is something called the emotional language, and that's the mother tongue. Mm-hmm. And it has to be very natural, which is why I also thank my mom that when it came to, when we were very, very young, she did speak Dutch to us. Mm-hmm. So I think that the first years are very important. Mm. It doesn't matter if later on during teenage, when there are hormonal changes and everything, this changes because you lose marks anyway and you learn constantly to find your marks. But I think that between, until you're six, it's important to have at least one very strong mark, and that's the mother tongue. So at least I know that the first years of my life she did speak. I mean, she sang in Dutch to me and spoke in English. There was something a little bit solid.
I think in a way this flexibility of language served you artistically, because so many people can get caught up and attached to what's okay, is this okay, is this not okay? And in your case, what you describe is, no, I used it as a tool of expression, like, it's okay if I'm gonna find my own sound in all of these languages.
Right.
You know, that you wrote in French, you wrote in English.
You needed guts, and also you needed to accept that for a very long time, I didn't feel legitimate to be in certain circles, or when people like my François Tardy contacted me to congratulate on some work, and then Henry Salvador and so. The thing is that when this happened, I was like, are they sure? Really? Like me of all people, why would they? And then I'm like, okay, I'll experience it. With Henri Salvador, it was crazy because when I was born, my mom listened to him all the time. So I knew his voice like you would know an instrument. Like as if like if you listen to a trumpet player or a clarinet or an oboe player your entire life since you're a baby, and suddenly you want to compose for that instrument, for that player. That's what happened with Henri Salvador, because his voice was so familiar.
Yes.
And I felt like, wow, I get to make this instrument malleable into my vision, and it sounds very pretentious like this, but it was actually very intuitive, and I was excited like somebody was taking me to Disneyland.
It's like writing fan fiction. It's like if somebody asked you to write your own fan fiction Harry Potter or something, and it's like, I know this story, I know these characters, I know this voice,
exactly.
I know how to write for this voice.
Yeah, exactly, I know this voice. I know why it touched me. I know which songs of this voice made me feel that I wanna, that like came to take me, because he had such a big repertoire already, but there were a certain amount of songs that I knew why I loved them more than others.
Yes.
And I'm like, that's where I want to go.
Ya Méditerranée, tous les flanflans, les airs démodés, une orange pressée. Ya Méditerranée, il fait trop froid pour aller nager, pour te faire danser dehors.
That was a beautiful experience, and it was very authentic. And beyond the fact that I got to write for him, I also got, you know, I was 23, he was 83. It's like getting a new grandpa kind of thing, you know, somebody gets into your life. And there's something, you can either remain very professional, but there's something very familiar that suddenly you spend time together and families, our families, you know, I met his family. I was just living here on my own. And he had a lot of tough family history with a lot of his own luggage. But we managed through songs and music to really get his career going again at 83. And wow, he had like another 6 years.
Jazz Mediterranée.
I loved doing that. I loved from all the things I got to do, I think writing songs remained the one that really needs a certain form of effort. It's not like if I write music for theater or for film, there's always a vision that comes before. It's layers. It's coming, you're trying to elevate or to make something that already exists, make it like find the language, find the frequency and go there and sit there and make it, take it where somebody wants it to go and then be a part of where you want it to go, but it's only part of something. But when you write songs, there's like air, and it's not like a poem where it has to be in your head, because a poem changes if somebody reads it out loud, you know. So if you read a poem in your head, it has a form, it has a shape, it has a frequency. A song is a sound already, like there is the harmony, there's the notes, the rhyme, like there's so many details that I think it's very satisfying. That's the one thing that I'm glad is that in my profession, because I feel that the first until a few years ago, I had so much motivation to work on things and to do things and to read and to visit and to travel and to be a mom and everything. And then I think at some point it shifts. It becomes discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've lived through it. For me, it was a very big change. The fact that motivation no longer works. It's just discipline. And then the desire comes with discipline. I think that's a big change.
That is so interesting. I mean, what I do feel is that talent, I think, is actually a byproduct of desire. Like, I think some people are born with some natural ability or some affinity, that talent is real, but without desire,
exactly,
it really doesn't matter. And you can have a lot of desire and not a lot of natural ability, and you'll get there.
That's, I think, the artists that actually manage to do what they love their entire life is also because of desire.
Absolutely.
And
but you're saying when you lose desire, then you need
discipline.
No, when
you lose motivation.
Yes.
Writing songs, I never lost the desire to write songs.
Yeah.
I know today that in order to be inside this desire and to constantly feed it, it needs discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It's also organization, because I think that you can't pollute your ears with things that do not satisfy you.
Interesting.
I can't. If I listen to something and it just, there is no satisfaction and I feel that it's inauthentic or anything, I feel that I don't have space, like mind space for it. So I need to reset with something that I love. So
did you recognize in yourself early on? Did people around you recognize in you? Did your parents recognize that you had a thing, that you were talented?
It was sort of obvious that I'll do something that has to do with music.
From what age?
Very young.
Yeah.
Even before I could pick up a guitar.
Because you sang?
Because I was very much into listening to records and dissociating piano from drums and bass and trying to understand who played this and that's the bass player who played there.
Really?
There was something is more like in terms of production. At the time, when a record we loved was released, we would listen to it on and read the credits and get into the life and the head. And the
with your parents?
No, as teenagers.
Uh-huh. With your friends.
On my own.
On your own.
Like, Tapestry.
Yeah.
Like just dissociating the instruments, understanding that in the same room there's a piano, there are drums. It was magical for me. It was insane. I loved writing songs.
Yeah.
I picked up a guitar pretty early, so I was 9 when I picked up a guitar. And that's where I literally started trying out bits and pieces and writing
songs. And that's more or less when you came to Paris.
Yes. I picked it up in Holland and we got here. Yeah. So it goes along with me being here. Yeah.
Do you have siblings?
Yes. I have a brother and a sister. They're older.
Much older?
My sister is 8 years older and my brother is 7 years older.
Musical?
I wouldn't say musical, but very fond of music, but not musical. None of them played an instrument or sang or anything. My dad was very artistic, but not musical. More worked with his hands. My mom was very artistic soul, but not music. For me, music was, it was just a great partnership. There's something, I still feel that what I get to experience listening to Chopin or Prokofiev, or, and maybe when I was young, it would be Springsteen, yeah, or some, I don't know, I could, going to see a show or a small, preferably in a small room with, yeah, some cats, yeah, something. What I get to experience with music, I still didn't get to experience through a movie or maybe literature, a book, but yeah, it's still, it's physically, there's something I got to live through music, yeah, that I didn't manage. I don't know if you feel that.
I can't decide, you know? I mean, the creative impulse was very strong, and if it wasn't music, I know that I would be in some sort of creative sense of self-expression and craft and all of that. Even making these, doing these interviews, I've learned that it actually sort of scratches a very similar itch for me of connecting, wow, with people, yeah, and making something and continuing to create constantly. So I don't know.
Because I feel, for example, I feel that I have this excuse because I love to draw and paint, but I'm so bad at it,
yeah,
that I don't have any responsibilities. So it's still, it's just a fun thing to do.
But that thing about responsibility is interesting. Did you feel that you had a responsibility,
yes,
to your
Before
talent?
I even have, yeah, had anyone, I had a responsibility to write things that, yeah, seemed good enough.
Yeah.
Then I had a responsibility to understand that good enough is not good enough. It has to be really good.
I feel that in your work. And I do think you started out with a real strong sensibility of this has to be great.
Yeah.
Like it was great.
I mean, at least for me. Yeah. I'm not saying it has to be great and people, yeah, are going to listen to it and going to think, yeah, it's great. But I have to experience that. It's been great. The process has been great.
Yeah.
And it's been great. And again, I think it is great for me because of the process.
Yeah. Do you suffer in the process?
I'm concentrated. I don't know if you call it suffering. But when I was young, I thought it was suffering. Yeah. I don't think so anymore. I think it's a privilege today.
Well, and as you said before, like, you know, we maybe confuse it with sadness, like,
yeah,
solitude.
I can get very low. Yeah. I can get very down,
yeah,
when I'm concentrated. Yeah. But I think it's if you look at the scientific, yeah, aspect of what happens in your body when you're concentrated and you're very focused and there's, yeah, labor, and also how, what decreases, like how the hormones work when you do that. There is a very good scientific explanation to what you're going through as a young person, even, and then when you're older, when you create, and also why you don't, it doesn't trigger as easily when you're older. So there is something scientifically proven or hormonal that is going on. So some people can call it suffering, but I think it's a privilege.
I want to say something to you that I was thinking about as I was listening through as much as I could before we spoke, because you have so much work. I feel a lot of discovery and searching in your work going back 10 records in 25 years, but I don't know that I would use the word development in the sense that I think you were very developed. I think there was a lot early on that was there and continues to be there. Like your writing was extremely strong early on, and I just hear you playing in the same sandbox for 25 years. Like you had a very strong sense of yourself, it seems to me, all the way going back.
I feel that, first of all, thank you. It's always so nice to hear, even though it's something that I'm incapable to, yeah, recognize,
yeah,
because sometimes I don't necessarily, I'm unable to listen to earlier work. You know, you have those moments in life. I can play the songs live,
yeah,
with the voice of today.
But when you hear that voice?
Well, it's not that I dislike it. It's just that certain recordings, I feel that I was probably so scared to, you know how in New Orleans they say that you only become a singer after 40. I understand what that means because I think that there is a certain state of mind as a musician, mm-hmm, after a certain age where it doesn't matter if you feel legitimate or not, you do what you do.
Yes.
You agree?
So much. Regardless of whatever your own hang-ups are or insecurities or whatever, it's undeniable that you've been doing this. This is what you've been living from. This is what you've been doing. You have this experience that carries you through.
Right,
that's,
yeah,
that's my feeling of it.
Yeah, yeah, so you just do it. You do it if you have a little bit of cold,
yes,
and your breath is not as fluid.
You do it.
And you do it. You do it if I know that I'm working on a project and somebody booked a studio from 9 till 5.
You go.
I go. That's where I have to be creative. That's where I have to be able to come up with something amazing.
Yes.
For that moment. And if the bass player cancels and I can't find a bass replacement, I'll have to either play the bass or program it or play it on the Moog or find a solution and make sure that this situation has traced what we're doing today, because that's what we do. We're recording. Yes. It's sort of like getting a witness of something.
A document. Yeah, yeah, we're documenting a moment. Yeah,
exactly. So the moment has to be good.
Yeah.
And we can't provoke a good moment, but we can be in it and do it, because we have to do it.
But as you say, so looking back, it's harder for you to hear yourself.
And I can hear myself, but it's harder for me because I remember that I was always very much into the craft of sound and everything. It was all very, very true and very authentic. But I can also hear that at some point I didn't feel legitimate in terms of my vocals, that I felt there are so many good singers out there. What am I doing singing? And
do people ever say to you, oh, you were so important to me, you were such an influence for me, you helped me find my voice? Or, you know, have people said that
absolutely.
To you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I always found it strange. Yeah. And but I mean, today I feel very much like a singer. Yeah. I mean, sometimes my voice is very tired, the live experience was always very real and authentic.
Yeah.
I think that maybe in some of the recordings at the studio, here's what I did. There are a few records, like Nolita, for example. I did record a lot of it on Broadway in Houston in a little room that I rented, that the acoustics were made for me for this record, and it was a great
experience. Was it a studio or was it an apartment? Or it was a studio.
It was a little office that became a studio in some office space that I rented.
Yeah.
And they had other recording studios there too. And the beauty of the place is that I could meet people at a gig or at a jam session and go back to the place and record. And Nolita has tons of soloists that actually I met in an elevator, or there was something very magical about it. And I feel that I was very confident in the crafting of this record. I felt it was my 4th record. So I felt that the exchange was necessary with other people and that the foundation was good, so I can just let them in. But today when I hear it, I'm like, what was I so afraid of when I was recording the vocals? Because I can feel that the room was tiny and small and I didn't want to wake up anyone.
You're whispering in the record a lot,
Yeah, and I'm like, it was probably the right thing to do then. But today when I sing one of the songs, like Chelsea Burns and stuff like that, I sing it out.
Chelsea Burns, you sing it, you almost are not speaking.
Exactly, and I'm like, it's as if I didn't want to wake up.
Yeah.
If somebody was jamming and then fell asleep on the couch and I still wanted to record the vocals, but I didn't want to wake
anybody up.
I was running out of trouble. You were running out of fame. Streets smell like the desert. They were putting out the flames. And Chelsea Burns.
That was the first record of yours that I heard. Did you feel that that was a breakthrough record, or it's 20 years ago now?
Artistically speaking, yes.
Career-wise?
Maybe career-wise too, I don't know. I never managed to really measure that. But I feel that the 3 records before, I was still exploring something very, either pop or folk. I don't know if that's the theme, but I was exploring things that there's a song and I want to illuminate it in some way. And then in Nolita, there was so much experimenting for me. I experimented a lot in the studio, and I tried out stuff and I just started programming. And
you have these very folk sounding things, and then all of a sudden there's like a Moog that shows up, or like you weren't afraid to mix things in non-traditional
ways. Rent some instruments or to buy some instrument toys and bring them to the studio and try out. It was a very lonely one too. There are a lot of guests, but there was something very lonely about Nolita. I was, I spent hours on my own. I was in New York. It was 2003, I think, when I recorded it. It came out in 2004. And a lot of things happened. I think the record before I met, I got the opening, like the open page of Arts and Leisure of the New York Times. So there was like a vibe going on, But I was so much into this record, and I was like, okay, focus, focus, because if you're just now with this happening, it was the beginning of when, you know, I was touring no longer solo, like I'll take a band, like a musician band, with me, yeah, or a little band and everything, and I'm like, and I was like trying to separate what was going on the road and what was going in the studio so I can really focus. It wasn't the same sound at all.
Yeah.
I was on the road playing songs from Not Going Anywhere, yeah, from other records, and then suddenly I was in the studio going to a different soundscape.
Yeah.
So it was very confusing, and there was something very lonely about it because I had to stay focused, but I was also young and I wanted to enjoy the rock and roll moment, and New York can give you that. But there is a price with it. There is like something that at the end of the day, I could like, between shows and between gigs, I'd stay sometimes for 3 days just on my own in the studio, and I'll go home to shower and...
It's funny though, because 20 years later, you make this record that is not about Paris, but is influenced by Paris and also influenced by solitude. I mean, you know, you talk about how lonely Nolita was. Now you open this record talking about the sort of the beauty of solitude and how much you...
Yes.
You love to live in solitude.
This is such a great point. I didn't think of this like that. It's true that Nolita was probably the first time I really... I'm not saying there wasn't a solitude of, as a writer for the other records, but
yeah,
there is something also when you're young, there's something very intuitive about the songs and you just, they come out. But the solitude of the, of you know, Virginia Woolf's, you know, just close the door and you have that room of yours,
yes,
to write in. It's a chosen one. I think when you're very, very young, you tend to mistake it for depression. Like people love the idea of the, especially in France, people like the idea of the young writer who is in some chambre de bonne, you,
yes,
know, some room and alcohol.
Yeah.
And like there's a misery about it.
Yeah, right.
But, well, when you get older, you understand that just sitting, writing, whether it's writing a novel or writing music or on the piano or on the guitar, it's just hours of labor. And at some point, your muscles are numb or they hurt and your back hurts. And
yeah,
this pain can go in, is physiological, but it's also very cerebral and it comes with the job and it brings fruit. And it's not depression, it's labor. It's long hours of work.
I mean, I hear you coming back to that again and again, that when, what did you say before? When the momentum goes,
yes,
away, then,
yeah,
then the work comes. And
exactly.
That it's a job.
It is.
Right, and maybe the sort of the youthful exuberance and idealism of being a young artist gets you through for a while, and at a,
right,
certain point in life, and also then you have a child, then you have a life, and you have responsibility, and you get comfortable, and you,
yeah,
know, and you think, you know, do I really want to do this work? That's when the discipline shows up.
Yeah, that's when the discipline shows up. And that's where I remember also a shift with 101 when I wrote All the Beautiful Girls. And I thought about the situation of being a New Yorker and being an artist. And what is it we need? Do we need recognition or do we need space to write? Or do we need a healthy living so we can write longer? Or do we need drinks and pills so we can write deeper? What's the right thing? And then you realize that you need nothing.
10 commandments. 9 moons of Jupiter. 8 individual resurrections. 7 days of creation. 6 sections of repetition. 5 books of Moses. 4 mothers. 3 fathers. 2 tablets of stone. 1 God.
The dependence is not something real. And I think that is also a part of the discipline. That is also a part of the states you can get yourself into just by hours of research or hours of playing. And then sometimes nothing comes and then the next day you just pick up the guitar and there it is.
Yes. Well, and I mean, I think about this with you because it seems that you continue to have things to say. And it's like, I think it's also easy as a writer sometimes to convince yourself that you're out of ideas. You know, I don't know if you feel,
yeah, that's
or
a
not.
Comfort zone to say, yeah, I have nothing. I need,
yeah,
to live stuff in,
yeah,
order to write them. But yeah. I mean, there is some of that because it takes longer to make records. I think when you're young, you can pop a record a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't happen to me,
yeah,
anymore. I don't know if you feel as creative as you were before.
Yeah, I'm mad at myself. I mean, I really want want every 18 months to 2 years to have a record?
Yes. Yeah, it depends on so many things and also of what you're trying to get. I mean, this past record is so... My records were always personal, but this one is even... It's intimate.
Yes.
More than personal. There's an intimacy to the way I speak about certain subjects that are sometimes uncomfortable for artists to speak about. I speak about adultery. I speak about... Comme si la mer se divisait is really... there is the biblical...
Parting of the sea.
Yeah, parting of the sea, but it's also mère and mère is mother in French.
Des allées vides de corps, de mouvements, de support, de fortune, de hibou.
Been touching some subjects that I loved to speak about before, but I have never spoken about so intimately. And I think that for that, I needed more time.
Yes.
So I think that sometimes when you want to be more precise or more exact in the definition or when you verbalize things in a way that is both poetic, but it's also very, very true to the feeling you're trying to give a physical form to, then I believe that it takes more time. Even if some of the songs come very quickly.
This record is, now that I think about it, primarily in French. There's a couple of songs. There's the song where you say, turn it up.
Wake me up, avant que je vois la vie à l'envers. Il faut que je freine, il faut que j'accélère. Hit me up, avant que tombe la pluie de l'enfer. Je peux m'en passer, mais je peux pas.
Yeah, yeah, it's just that.
It's just
all
that,
the rest,
right?
Yeah, all the rest in French. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is that, do you think, just a result of living here right now?
Maybe it's a new, it's sort of a new chapter with the French language. I feel that this past few years, I got a lot into poetry. I got to do this project for theater. It took more of me because I also had a poetry. I looked into translators and then I got interested in translators in general because I like to read a lot of things that are translated from Yiddish. And there were a few new translators that have retranslated works of Baal Shem Tov Singer or his brother, Joshua Israel Singer, to French. I saw this translation, I bumped onto one, and then I saw that it was a new translation. So I looked at the other things that I've read in English before. And I found that translation to be really, really good.
Yeah.
I kind of reread classics in French, and I'm like, wow, I wonder if I had read them in French at the time, because these are all translations.
Yeah.
At the time, I read the translation to English. I wonder what sort of person it would have, like, it would have changed who I am, because literature has, is a big part of choices I made, I think, and...
Artistic choices or personal choices?
Artistic choices for words and for, aesthetics in art. The French gave me other things, like other choices of atmosphere, of scent and frequency. I think I felt like this was a time to explore more the French language as a writer,
I feel, I don't speak enough French to have a strong opinion about it, but I'm still going to try. Because what I feel is that sound and meaning are tied in a beautiful way in your writing. Like, for example, I listened to the record first and then I read some of the translations. Even like Paris Amour.
Yeah.
There's so much sound in the, especially in the chorus, right? Where
right.
you're like, it has impact because of the repetition of these rhymes and of these sounds. And it also, it's meaningful.
Paris, t'es dur, Paris, toujours, Paris, tu m'as périmé. De Paris Amour, Paris, toujours, Paris, je te quitte.
I imagine you, as you're writing, allowing sound to lead or getting
Absolutely.
Fixated on a certain kind of repetition of sound and then finding those beautiful moments.
I love what you just said, because I love allowing sound to lead.
Yeah.
I feel that there is always a way to let sound take over and still say what you want to say.
Yes.
So
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's weird, right? Because sometimes if you write it down, it wouldn't work. But with this note on this harmony, this, you know, chord progression or that little blue note on there or gives a sense that is missing with just the word or just the note.
But this is where the idea is, like my father always used to say to me, you know, a lyric is not poetry set to music. A lyric is its own, it's its own thing, and it's because it has to work musically as well as, you know, have meaning and have sense and be an artful.
I agree so much to this. I'll allow myself to take it further. Poetry, if somebody reads you out loud a poem, there's already music to it.
Yeah.
If you read it on your own, I said that earlier, if you read it on your own, that's where the poem is. That's the circle.
Right.
That's where it's the how the writer
intended it.
No matter if we both read it differently inside our heads, that's what was intended.
As soon as it becomes mediated through somebody's voice, it's already changed.
It's already put into music.
Yes.
Yes.
The music of somebody's
voice. Yeah,
yeah. That's true.
I think it's wonderful because, you know, the voice is everything of a person, you know, and it's in motion and changes. It carries so much of what the person has lived and every bit of sun that you know, that it's been to and rain, everything is
every
in the voice.
Every sunset you've ever seen,
exactly.
every rainfall, of course.
There's so much information in a voice. And this is also probably, if we go back to me criticizing my recordings, that's where I usually become indulgent and tell myself that I shouldn't be criticizing earlier recordings, because there is something very truthful about it's just the voice. There is no effort like a sport or an athletic effort to bring the voice, the vocals out. I do it on stage, but in the recordings, there was something that was just telling the story.
Yeah.
But I think in the telling, I did give a lot of information because my voice carried it at the time this way. So I still think it was true, and it is true.
Even if it captures your insecurity, that insecurity was actually
a part of
you
it.
Were.
Yes, that, absolutely.
That was the document.
Yeah.
So the other piece of it, though, that comes forward, and to me, I think, I mean, I thought a lot about Nolita and Paris Amour as these sort of, I don't know, two poles, because they both communicate an importance of place in the work. Like Nolita was, just naming the record Nolita was to say, like, I've been in New York. This is a New York, this is a statement of New York, even if the whole record wasn't all about New York, or even if you
see...
There's a lot about Paris.
Yeah.
And here
I even talk about Abbess and everything. Yeah,
right. Yeah. But you also had Chelsea Burns, and you also...
Yes.
And then here you have a record that's, like, devoted to Paris, although, like, you assert this is not a record about Paris.
No, it's speaking to and from Paris, but about other places. There's a lot of water and the sea and seashores and...
So how does where you are when you're writing affect or influence what you're writing?
It's a very good question. It does a lot. It's a very big part of if you can't hear it in the song, I hear it in my head. There are songs that I remember. There's a song called Where No Endings End on the eponymous record of 2007, and I wrote this in Mexico. I was there and I picked up a guitar and I wrote the song. It has nothing to do with Mexico and it speaks about the Middle East. And you know, you and I, we both run with an unloaded gun for the same piece of land. We're no endings end. It was like a very, the song is really something that has to do with where I come from.
You and I, we both run with an unloaded gun for the same piece of land.
I hear it and I feel the sun on my skin. So I think the song, even though it speaks about something tragic, there's a lot of luminosity in it.
Yeah.
Thanks to the fact that I wrote it with
in
the sun on my skin. Yes.
I want to ask you, and you can easily say, I don't want to speak about it, I don't have much to speak about it, but just being a Jew in France over the years, and particularly today, if you feel that there's been a change, a shift.
I just feel that the hatred came to the surface.
Yeah.
I knew it was there.
Yeah.
We know it's there. I mean, I always felt it between the lines, but I never, for me, it was never an issue because you sort of live with it. And then the funny thing is that most of your friends would say, no, that doesn't exist. So you don't even go into it. You just know it's there. You know there's something uncomfortable that can make people uncomfortable. And then you just have to explain to your kid where it comes from and the history. October 7th sort of opened the beast, and so many people who didn't feel comfortable expressing it unknowingly are expressing it today.
Yes.
It's there. It's everywhere. I feel that I need to focus on creating good things.
Yeah.
On creating also a good environment for my family.
Yeah.
On having, and I do have great relationships, whether in friendship or in my family or at work.
Yeah.
And I feel that I'm doing that. So I don't think that, you know, people can disagree with my opinions. I can disagree with it. It's fine. I don't mind. I can have dinner with, I can have oysters with somebody I disagree with. That doesn't bother me. We don't need to agree.
Yes.
We don't need to give responsibility to people where they don't have it.
That's interesting. Like, one of the things that I notice as a mostly secular Jew who grew up in the States is that we have a lot of options in terms of how we want to identify as Jews, and we can choose to be culturally more Jewish, or we can, you know, that there are a lot of ways to be Jewish in the States. And I felt when I started spending time in Europe that I either found people who are like very religious, or who basically said, well, my family's Jewish, but I'm not really Jewish. You know, that they didn't find a way in between.
Yeah, because they were complexed to identify.
Right.
But I think this has changed in the past 2 years, because you understood that if you're a little bit, there's no such thing being a little bit Jew. I think most of the Jewish on earth are secular.
Yes, I mean, I think so too.
I grew up, we weren't. I mean, but religious, I love doing Shabbos with my friends and inviting not necessarily Jews,
or,
and then going to have, like, we have great tables, and
and
I love anything that is traditional in the Jewish religion, I absolutely love. And it's also a book of tools, you know, the Talmud and everything is a tools of life. There is something very intuitive when it comes to survival and resilience, which is just in the DNA, I guess. I don't know. But I think it's a great tradition. Being a Jew never made me get attached to this community.
Yeah.
I mean, my community would be the parents at school when we get together, or the people that I meet at the cafe in the morning, the community that I go hang with after a show, my friends. You know, I was never like a Jewish community, but I do think today how important it is of a community, because there's been so much trash going over us, over our heads in the past 2 years. Like, it's crazy. And we have to deal with, I have to deal with things that nobody in my surrounding has to deal with. Like, I have to, you know how many festivals need you to express some things before you? I'm not even getting into that. Like, fuck you if you don't want me there.
Yeah.
It's fine, you
yeah.
know? I mean, those Jews that you say that don't necessarily feel Jews and stuff, I don't need anybody to feel Jew. I just feel that those who need that, they have to overdo it because they're Jewish.
Uh-huh.
I think it's horrible. I don't get that. Those who overdo it, like, would never speak about Sudan and Congo, but they need to overspeak about Palestine. Like, I think it's ridiculous.
Yes.
I just don't. It's like, either you're a human being or you're not.
Yes.
So if you're going to defend populations and fight for rights, just fight for education first. Like, educate yourself first.
Well, it seems like the word investigation has been circling around this whole conversation, that you know, you've said a few times, like, I've been doing this investigation on this. I've been thinking about, I've been doing this research on this.
Thinking,
it seems like that's a big part of your process in general, is just like looking into things.
I'm trying to educate myself as much as possible about topics. There's so much access to information that this in itself is already an effort to know where to get the information. That's why I say literature. For me, reading Stefan Zweig is documenting way more reality about Europe than any other history document that you can find.
Or the newspaper
online.
Today.
Yeah. So when I say investigating or researching, for me, it's probably reading a lot of books that were written between the First and Second World War and also post-World War II.
Yeah.
That for me would be educating myself as much as possible about what really happened through literature and through... I think if somebody asked me what two books to read to understand the pre-war situation and to understand how much it could be dangerous because we're somewhere, we're not
close,
far,
yeah,
I would say Karnofsky Family by Israel Joshua Singer. It's the brother of Bolshevik Singer.
Yeah.
And Stefan Zweig's The World of Yesterday.
Okay.
That's how it's translated, yeah. Either The World Before Us or The World of Yesterday.
Okay.
I think there have been two translations, yeah. And for me, these two books, before anybody should give any opinion about anything or shutting down anything that is really, because anti-Semitism doesn't concern Jews. It's like, it's the big, it's not only Jews. It concerns so much more than that. It's discernment beyond, and that's where you understand these things.
What does your daughter see of you working, and what is her view of you?
So for her, she's probably the only one in my life that has been through all process of writing. Yeah. When she was a baby, I remember I was working on a film score, and she was in this scarf, while I was working, and she had those baby headphones too that did not make to make sure that she doesn't get any aggressive sound, and she was with me everywhere. But for her, it's such a part of the day. Sometimes she comes back from school, and if I'm still working on something that she's capable of. There is this song on a record called Les Désirs Fatigués des Navires d'Argent. It's called the exhausted desire or the tired desire of silver ships. Or by silver, I meant the silver. You know, I have my hair is like I let my hair grow.
A little gray.
Yeah. And I was like, it's about a woman who's who has a partner who wants to take her to Venice and to all around the world. And she loves that he wants to take her, but she just wants to be home with her cat, and you know, and so it's funny. So I work on the songs, and then one day she came from home from school, and I had just finished the last verse, which is the closing verse.
Yeah.
And I finish it, and I play it, and then she looks at me and goes like, "She's just really, she's had it."
So she's in it with you. She's,
yeah, yeah.
She
she's like,
it.
Yeah, she's had it. You're right. You got this. Like she's had it. Like she didn't say, are you tired of traveling? Or she understands the narration that I'm telling something that I may have experience in or everything, but I'm telling a story that I'm a storyteller. And she was referring to the person I'm speaking on the first as a first person.
Yes.
Les désirs fatigués des navires d'argent, ton allure distinguée et ton cœur brûlant. Que veux-tu que j'en fasse? Ou veux-tu que je t'embrasse, mon amour? Nos balades en forêt de Montmorency, comme ces fades et barbants de flâner ainsi. Ça me fout mal, ça me plombe, ça m'enfonce dans la tombe, mon amour. C'est sûrement romantique, la falaise volcanique, le cap vers l'Amérique, la banquise antarctique. Oui, je rêve de Venise, mais en toute franchise. Préparer les valises, mon amour, ça m'épuise.
But that's interesting that she understands that, something that I think probably a lot of people don't understand. I don't often understand with writers. I'm often questioning and then forcing myself to remember that it doesn't matter if the person telling the story lived this story or not, and if they're telling me something that they that is confessional, or if they're just telling a story,
who
or
cares?
Some combination of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, who cares? As long as the emotion is lived.
Yes.
You know, I mean, we've all had a broken heart. It doesn't matter how you explain it.
Yes.
I mean, I think that there are songs, like the song about infidelity called the Strange Experience of the Unequal, the L'Expérience étrange de l'Inégal. I don't know if I would have been able to write it if I hadn't lived through it. Mm. But it doesn't matter if I lived it now or when I was young or when I've seen others live it and it reminded me, or when I understood the analysis of somebody who does that. I think it takes time to understand as a woman also that people make mistakes by fear of loss. And I always love to write from a point of view that is non-judgmental.
Mm.
For me, it's very important.
Yes.
Montre-moi cette chose invisible de l'autre côté de la porte.
Je veux connaître la matière grise, les non-dits, les non-vus qui t'emportent. Chante-moi cet air inconnu, magnifiquement répétitif. Puisque moi tu m'as sans retouche, sans secret sur le vif.
Have you spent time in therapy?
Oh, yeah. I had a 15-year psychoanalysis when I was young, and then I stopped for about 6 years, and then I had started another one. Yeah, yeah. I'm a big fan of Freud, Lacan, Jung. I'm like, These are my great teachers.
Because I think in a way, like, that's very helpful in terms of reaching a sense of non-judgment. I'm in therapy now, and I feel like that's a big part of it, is just understanding, like, you have to be able to see yourself and express yourself without the judgment of what you're feeling or what you're, you know.
It's harder when it's on yourself. Like, I mean, when you start therapy, you manage to be non-judgmental towards others.
Yeah.
But it takes a very long time to be non-judgmental
towards yourself. Yes. So a friend of mine said that he saw an interview with you here in France where you said something like that you decided to make this record instead of buying a new car or something like that.
The story I told was that I went to see my banker to get a loan to make this record.
Yes.
And he said, I thought you came to get a loan to get a country house.
I see. Based on what you're asking for, it looks like you wanted to buy a house. But that does speak to the fact that now you're financing these records and you've started a label, and, you know, like, we're talking about this period 2 decades ago where you were on Blue Note and you had relationships with labels, but now at a certain point you've decided, I'm just going to do this myself.
It's also, I think there is something very frustrating to know that today many companies, I mean, there are some great indie labels that do a great job, but I mean, I don't see other than negotiating stuff with radios and stuff. I don't see what they can bring that I can't when it comes to my project. Not saying about other projects.
Yeah.
There's nobody knows your project better than you.
Absolutely.
So, you know. And then I thought, okay, I could try a major label. I've done that before. But then I realized that in this economy, artists are just the, you know, expenses, like the untaxable, how do you call it in English?
When write-offs.
Yeah, the write-offs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, so, like, do I want to be somebody write or somebody write-off? Because I don't think the economy can bring them back anything they can invest in. Does this come with a price? Am I stuck? So I'm like, I've tried it. It wasn't for me. I'd like to do it on my own. I'm not saying this will be the way from now on, because I'm sure I'll have more collaborations and I have friends who have labels and we'll figure it out. It's a lot of work. It's exhausting. But I think it's essential to give it a try.
Yeah.
It changes the rhythm. There is something when you release a record with a label, so many people are dependent on a schedule because they have this amount of time, this period of time to work on your record and press and radio and media and then book the touring. It's a whole thing.
And then they're going to have another record 2 months
from now. And then another record But when it's your own,
you can
I can decide that now for 2 years. That's all I do. I mean, I do need to make money, so I do work on film and theater, and I do shows and I tour. But I mean, I can work on promoting this record as long as I'd like and take the time and not stress myself and lose my hair because I only have a window of 2 months to make it happen and say it's either in or out, you know?
That's so interesting, and actually it speaks to what we're doing right now in the sense that, like, you know, we first talked about this through your publicist when you were in New York a month ago. And I said, no, I'd rather do it when I'm in Paris, and I want to, especially this record, I want to talk to Karen Ann in Paris, if I'm going to be there, you know. And it was like, okay, that's cool, because the window of promotion of the record is wider. You're able to say, it's great, and then people will talk about it 2 months after the record
came
out. It's better, actually.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, a record has a life. I've been discovering records that I missed of some artists that I love. I don't know that somebody else would know how to work my record the way I want it.
Then the question is, you know, you also have the benefit of 25 years of career, having gone through all these label relationships and having established yourself so that you don't really have to explain who you are. You just have to talk about this project.
Right.
And so I often think, because I agree with you, I don't know what a label can do. I mean, a label really can't do anything for you until you've already built something. And I think like younger artists today are expected to build it through social media and
right.
through, other ways. But like, it seems like it's easier to do what you're doing, or at least you can maybe get further with it once you already have an established
yes,
career.
Yes, a daughter of a friend of mine who is now starting a career, and she's super talented, and she did an EP, and now she's working on another EP, and I was talking to her, and I'm like, why don't you work on an album
yeah.
for your next one? And she was like, I don't know that I want to. And then I thought about it, I'm like, she's right. You know, she says, for now, I just want to do EPs and look from the sound. I'll do an album when I have a better vision of...
Yeah.
It's cool. She can do it. She can still live with her mom and do
yeah.
it, you know. But then I realized that's great. I didn't have a choice because I needed to... I put everything in my records and I had a day job. It was still
yeah.
music.
Yeah.
I was still making music and writing songs for other.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm saying that as
yeah.
a singer, it came
yeah.
pretty late. I was already making money with music, writing songs for people. I remember the first check I got after I wrote a hit.
Yeah.
You know, it was Jardin d'Hiver. And then suddenly, like, I could invite all my friends to have sushi.
Mm-hmm.
And sushi wasn't very common at the time
yeah.
in
yeah.
Europe, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
so it was like, wow, that was
yeah.
insane. This doesn't happen today.
Yeah.
Like, I can have a hit. I still won't be able to invite
everyone
for sushi, yeah. maybe pizza, you know?
Yeah.
So the economy is so different that they don't have that pressure. Anyway, it's very rare to be able to live off of it. So they don't have
I know.
Pressure.
Well, I noticed that too with streaming. Like, young people 10 years younger than me even are like not upset with the Spotify model because
yes.
it's the only model that
they
ever
know.
Knew. So they say, I don't know, what's the problem? It's like, it's okay.
Yeah, but we know, like, if you, as a writer,
yeah.
it's hell. Like, where does the publishing
yeah.
goes? It's,
yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And how do you feel about the world for your daughter? Are you optimistic for the world for your daughter?
I think I've lived in the best period that could have been, and unfortunately I can't say that it's coming for her. I think that I have to make sure that she gets enough guidance when it comes to digital era. And
how old is she?
She's 13
yeah.
and AI. And alas, I have to include that and
yeah.
bring it into her upbringing. So alas and not alas, because I'd rather she'd be educated about it. And I think it's already too late to try and change anything, and it's a part of everything. I still want her to enjoy the process of living.
Yeah.
And this is my goal, that she enjoys to learn a new Chopin on the piano, that she enjoys a good meal, and that
yeah.
she enjoys making, creating, educating herself, that she enjoys academia when it comes to certain aspects, that I think it's a privilege to also study and,
yes.
and get information. And I hope she's very artistic and she's a math head, but I was both too, so I guess she'll need to make a choice, but whatever she chooses to do, I hope she enjoys the process
yes.
of getting where she wants to get.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I want to teach her. I want to make sure she enjoys the itinerary, because we don't know what's tomorrow
yes.
kind of thing. You know, like, we don't know. It's really fast. It goes very, I mean, evolution is fast.
You know, again, I think about my, you know, what you described with your relationship with your daughter, you know, in just in general terms, it does feel sort of evocative of my relationship with my father. And one thing that he used to say to me, and really still says, is like, the work will never let you down. Focus on your work. The doing. Do the work.
I agree. The doing, the making, yeah. That's why I said she's both artistic and a math head, because she works with her hands,
yeah.
but she also likes to work, to understand. I think she could be scientific if she
yeah.
wants to, but whatever she chooses, I want her to enjoy the process.
But as you say, I want her, the process
yeah.
is the thing.
Yes, because we get access to solutions now.
Yeah.
You can type, I want this song.
Sure.
I want this sounding voice and these chords
yes.
and this, and then it comes out of the machine.
You know, I spoke earlier to you about desire and my sense of how important desire is to the process and to whatever talent is, or you know, but actually the reality is that, like, the difference between AI and us is that AI has no process.
Exactly. That's I always talk
yeah.
about this when people ask me about AI, and I love talking about this topic.
Yeah.
The process.
Yeah.
We're not artists because of the
results.
Results.
Yeah. We're artists because of the process.
Process, exactly. So the AI can't take the process away from
right.
me.
Right. It can't.
It can give you the result.
It can give you a result.
If you want a result from an AI, yeah. you can have it. But for me,
yeah.
it's not taking anything away from me.
Yes.
It's not maybe salary, but you know, that's, I'll find it elsewhere. But I mean, it's not taking anything away from me. The process is still mine.
Yes. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful insight. And I'm not sure that that's one that I have heard in that way yet. And that is very helpful.
I get more better off for doing like a talk or a masterclass yeah. in festivals than I do for a solo show.
Totally.
Yeah, yeah. So it's funny, I go and do these sometimes, you know, in festivals and we talk and there is Q&As. And I found myself talking a lot about the process also because there was a festival that was more axed on, like it was more focused on poetry.
Yeah.
So I went as a songwriter, as a singer, but we talked a lot about poetry and I gave examples, poets and female poets and then, or male poets or like Bukowski, for example, versus Dickinson or Plath, uh-huh. even if it's not the same era, but just, you know, there is something that is very obvious when you read each is what architecture
uh-huh.
and attraction to certain consonants and words.
Ah.
So if you analyze it, you see that there is something very, you could, when you're a poet, you're some sort of an architect. There is
yeah.
some of that.
Yeah, interesting.
When if you give an AI.
A linguistic architect.
Yeah, exactly. And if you give AI, if you ask for a poem, and you say, I want it to be about the autumn and there is a man or whatever. If you take it out, it will be nude from gravity
uh-huh.
of the consonants
yes.
and architecture. So I'm not saying it won't have qualities, it will.
Yeah.
But these are what makes the identity of somebody.
Yes.
The fact that it has no identity and you have to give it the identity
yes.
is very interesting.
Yes.
Because you get the content before you get the identity
yes.
who actually created it. Because that's what people do. I understood that Universal is now creating music and then they're making a band name. They're doing this trial thing. So it's the other way around. But it has no gravity.
Yes.
Like, I don't know where it lands. So it's very interesting.
I mean, that's an interesting question also is like, if ultimately the end result were to be the same, if AI could write Paris Amour,
yeah.
would it have the same gravity if it hadn't gone through the same process?
I carry the gravity.
Yeah.
So if there's
you
nobody
carry the
to
gravity.
Carry it,
yeah.
what does it represent?
Yeah.
So yeah, probably for the listener, maybe. But for me as an artist, no. So what's important is for me, the process, the gravity,
yes.
the where it lands.
And art is a kind of a conversation between the artist and the receiver.
And what they're, yeah, exactly. So maybe it'll be a one-way conversation.
Yeah. I still
feel that there is something that AI didn't manage to get in terms of emotion and frequency and sound.
Yeah.
Until it gets it. We still have that questioning to do.
Yeah. Karen Ann, thank you for doing some questioning with me today. This
thank
has been
you.
So fun.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very flattered and I'm very happy we got to do this here in Paris.
Yeah, me too.
And to have this conversation.
There she was, my friends, Karen Ann, a deep thinker and a full-time searcher. The Third Story is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Leo Sidran. This week I had production help from Ray Long. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.